This week on Future of Sex.
Let me ask, how many people here expect to get their porn for free?
Really good sex is illicit and naughty and forbidden and a little edgy, and you should feel incredibly embarrassed after you have good sex.
I would ask everyone here to rethink what their own preconceived notions are of what it means that someone may have done sex work. Maybe they just shot one porn. Maybe they did it for one specific reason that they can point to, like college. Maybe they did it because they had a reason like paying their fucking rent.
A lot of women want to feel emotionally connected before they have sex, and a lot of men feel emotionally connected from having sex.
How do we teach our children about how to stroke your own clitoris? How do you, like, stroke a woman's clitoris? Like, how are we supposed to do that in a way that sets our kids up for success in a culture that freaks the shit out when you talk about this?
I grew up with a magnet on my fridge, and it was like one of those 1950s cartoons with the speech bubble, and it was the mom talking to the daughter, and it said, "Darling, God's gift to women wasn't men, it was the shower massager." And so I just assumed that masturbation was what I was supposed to do.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Hi, I'm Bryony, and welcome to Future of Sex, the podcast that explores the evolving worlds of sex and tech. This is the latest installment in our Salon series, the series that brings live podcast events to your bedroom, or on the train, or in your house, or car, wherever you happen to be listening to this podcast. Now, this event took place at Fifth House in Williamsburg, Brooklyn. The topic was Tinder, teledildonics, and sex in 2020. And it is a power-packed panel, try saying that fast three times, of women from therapy, sexology, media, and pornography backgrounds. And one of the interesting things about studying the future of sex and sex tech is that a lot of it has nothing to do with technology and everything to do with being human, which is why I felt it was important to bring together people from different fields, people from research, therapy, porn, to truly understand what the future holds. Now, these discussions feel like a way we can release the shame and stigma about sex and start a real dialogue about what is happening to humanity and how we might begin to understand it. I'm so honoured to be able to select people for you, people I've learned from personally, whether attending their courses, listening to their podcasts, reading their articles, or simply spending time in their presence. So today, I'll share some very special people with you who are thinking about sexuality, how it's changing, and we'll explore how technology is going to change our attitudes and the way we have sex, specifically its impact on women. Now, probably know this already, but before we get started, we just want to remind you this podcast does contain explicit language and adult themes. So please make sure you've got headphones in if there are little ones around. Now, let's get to it.
And tonight I am delighted to welcome some people that I have been fangirling over for the past year. So it's kind of like I'm living out my dreams right now, having you guys up in front of me. No shit at all.
Not my fantasies,
okay. But you did do a good podcast on fantasies, so we'll get to that later. But the whole point of having these events is to bring people together that are of the same mindset, that want to know more, that have probably gone beyond 101 and want to go deeper into a conversation about sexuality and recognize that technology is really influencing our lives in major ways, in the way we date, the way we fall in love, the way we have sex. And I am so excited to bring together people from different fields of sexuality, because I think what's really important, and when we talk about sex tech, people always think it's about technology or they think it's about VR porn, but there's so much more under this umbrella of sex tech. And tonight we're bringing together amazing fields, from therapy to documentary filmmaker to research museum of sex to podcaster extraordinaire. So we're about to go deep. Are you ready?
Yeah.
Awesome. So the format I like to follow is to introduce all of these amazing powerhouses up here and ask them a custom question. So you really get involved with their work and you understand what they do. And then I've prepared some questions of my own, which I want to ask about Tinder, teledildonics, what the world looks like in 2020. So we'll dive into them. And by then, you will probably have some questions. So we'll hand it over to you to ask your questions and then we'll wrap and party. Sound good?
Yeah.
All right. So I'm going to go from the very far side over. First of all, welcome Dr. Tammy Nelson. I'm so excited to have you here.
Thank you.
So can I call you Tammy?
Yes, please.
Okay. So Tammy travels the world talking to students, talking to couples, also talking to sex therapists about relationship structures and how they change. And Tammy and I came to know each other through a friend, and she invited me out to DC to do her four-day course alongside aspiring sex therapists, so psychotherapists that wanted to get their credits to become a sex therapist. And I always tell this story about Tammy, and people are like, wow, I want to go to this too. It's called a SAR. So Tammy hosts this one day called Sexual Attitude Readjustment that all therapists must go through. And I cannot unsee all those things. My attitude has been readjusted. But I think what you're most well known for is the new, well, your latest book is The New Monogamy. And talking to people about how relationships are changing, how if someone's unfaithful in a marriage, that's not the end of the marriage and what that means. And so I'm really curious as a futurist and just as a human about how you're looking at the future of relationships now and the future of monogamy.
Thank you, first of all, for having me on this illustrious panel. Very excited. And this really hip audience. I feel like I got some hip cred with my stepdaughter who lives in Brooklyn. And I really, really appreciate you bringing me on to talk about the new monogamy, because the new monogamy, the way that I talk about it, is a description of how we can all structure our relationships. So there's a continuum of monogamy. There is really traditional monogamy where you come home and tell your partner that you had a fantasy about someone else or someone else turned you on in the grocery store. Because you sin in your heart that way. And some people really feel you should have a totally transparent relationship, or else it's like a slippery slope. All the way to the other end of the continuum with people who are openly polyamorous, who have multiple pods of partners and a really complicated schedule. And so the way I define the new monogamy is you can fall anywhere on that continuum, but the idea is to have conversations and make your monogamy explicit. So whatever it is, it doesn't matter to me what it is. It matters more that you can talk about it. And that we change over time as we get older, as our relationships get older, that monogamy is developmental. Mm. So what you want now may not be what you want when you're my age or 10 years from now or 5 years from now or even next week. And so, you know, it's so interesting to me that in our culture we have to renew our license every couple of years. But you make this one-time vow against infidelity is supposed to like last a lifetime. It's sort of like when people say, well, I told you I loved you when I married you. I'll let you know if I change my mind. So this is really a sustainable relationship model, a way to create a relationship that may last. You can have many marriages within the lifetime of your marriage, or you can be married to different people, or you can never marry. Every year on New Year's Eve with my husband, like, we look at what worked and what were the shining moments and where did we connect and what do we want for next year? Like, to set an intention or a vision for your relationship, how often do I do this with my career? Like, all the time. Mm-hmm. I make a plan, I set intentions, I have goals. I don't do any of that with my marriage unless it's really conscious. And it doesn't have to be like, okay, let's sit down and have a dialogue. You know, and when my husband says, can you please pass the salt? I say, so what you're saying is, can I pass the salt? It's really hard living with a therapist. But it's so important to renew that conversation. You know, I was just talking to someone here who's 26, and she said, you know, the one thing that we don't do is talk about our relationship. So we try to be cool and like not be the first one that admits that we want to commit, because then we're not, you know, hip and cool, and we're not polyamorous, or we're not open, and somehow commitment and monogamy has become like this dirty word. And you know, monogamy is a practice. It's like a sacred practice. It's like yoga or meditation. If you choose to practice every day, it's a choice you make. But it should be something that you honor together as a couple and don't let anybody else mess with.
Thank you. Welcome to the future of sex. Future of relationships. Sue J. Johnson, welcome. I'm so excited to have you here. We met only a couple of weeks ago when I found out Sue J. was on a residency at TED. We all know TED by now, with one of my friends, and then went deeper and discovered you've been studying women for 20 years. You've covered the first boxer, female boxer in the Olympics, which was a five-year project, and now she's studying real people's real sex lives from all different walks of life and uncovering those stories, as well as thinking about the talk. That we give to children. And you label it the talk 2.0. Mm-hmm. I wonder if you could just elaborate on that, give us a sneak peek of what you've been thinking about.
Yeah, I am the mother of two daughters, 11 and 12. And in doing all of this work of really looking at women in different societies and how women are allowed to present themselves at different points in time, like all the rituals that we have, like weddings and debutante balls, is coming out parties, like how women are really constrained all the time in the ways that they can represent themselves. And part of following the women boxers was looking for examples of women who are willing to just really push the margins of how they're going to be in the world and what that looks like when they're in the midst of that, of coming up against so much bias, gender bias, race bias, class bias, and they're like, could not care less about how they're being perceived and what that's going to cost them. And so it's coming out of the boxing work, following this phenomenal teenage boxer, Clarissa Shields, who at the age of 17 was the first woman to get the gold medal at the Olympics. And I just started really thinking about what is it that she's doing as a young girl that she's able to really be herself. Like, she's the most authentic young woman I've ever met. And I'm like, what are her practices? And so I started studying resiliency, and she's in her own teenage way doing all these beautiful things that are inherent to resilient people. They have discipline, they're healthy, they have mentors, she's physically in her body. But then I thought, you know, there's the one thing that I hadn't really encountered anywhere was she really understands pleasure. And it's such a priority for her. Like, she knows how to take care of her body and does things that bring her pleasure in the society. Like, she's like, I don't care what you think. I'm like, I take such pleasure in beating women up. I take pleasure in being with my boyfriend. And she takes such pleasure in laughing, too. Like, I would watch her go from these. She's from Flint. And so going from these extremely beautiful situations, like winning the gold medal, to taking a phone call, like, your brother's in prison, and, like, you need to go home and get him out right away. So she's able to, like, turn it on a dime and really prioritize the joy. Like, as soon as she could, she'd get right back to the joy. So I started researching pleasure, and this brought me to, of course, sex. And interviewing people over the course of the year, from looking at sex from a disabled perspective, I'm currently looking for a nun. I want to talk about celibacy and sex and what can we learn there. And talking to cuddlists and people who've come from all different places, every single person shares the same story of, I had this incredible first conscious thought. I had an erection. I was five. I was in a little playhouse with a five-year-old girl. We were playing house, and I felt this excitement in my penis, and I ran home and I told my mother about it, and like, and then it begins. Like, mm-hmm. every single person has that awakening moment, and then oh, the next memory is, you were told, you know, shut that down immediately. So I'm really thinking about, like, well, how do we communicate to our kids not just sex, but pleasure and desire? And how do we, in this age of consent, conversation about consent, like, how do we bring our kids in really early on to know what that feels in their body? Not just to communicate it in language, but, like, what does that feel like to be really present in your body with another person? Can you feel that energy? What does that feel like when I honor your boundaries? I've been playing games with my kids, and, like, my daughter says, rub my back. So I say, well, how do you want me to rub your back? And I wait. Like, I really insist that she practice this kind of agency of, like, oh, I'm going to tell you what brings me pleasure, and I'm going to learn how to say it to you in a way that's going to get you to do that for me. So I'm so conscious now as a parent, like, how I'm touching my children is the way in which they will expect to be touched when they're with an intimate partner. And this is a super edgy thing to talk about in our culture, where parents aren't supposed to touch their children in a pleasurable way, or take pleasure from touching their children, or how do we teach our children about how to stroke your own clitoris? How do you, like, or to stroke a woman's clitoris? Like, how are we supposed to do that in a way that sets our kids up for success in a culture that freaks the shit out when you talk about this? So this is where all this work is taking me, of really investigating, like, what can we do as parents to keep our kids intact? They're so perfect when they're born. They're so, they're like these little sensual creatures. And then we have 6 years to get them to, like, sit in a chair and, like, you know, like, how do we keep them intact, especially when they're teenagers? When I'm noticing, like, no one's touching my kids anymore. I'm like, they're busy. And it's like, I think that we maybe touch for, like, a minute a day. And so I'm looking for all these moments where I can just, like, touch them. So this is the Talk 2.0.
I love it. Cool. Could you hear Sue up the back there? Okay, wasn't sure. Yes. Just so curious if anyone here in the room felt like they had a great sex education from their parents, if you would put your hands up and then Sue J can come and find you afterwards.
Yes, thank
to
you.
Talk to you yes. about that. There because you go. I think we need examples.
Two people.
And yeah, it's telling when...
Wow. Even, you know, in this room of people who are, like, really thinking and conscious and you've arrived at this place. But still, no one feels like they had a leg up from their parents.
Mm. Yeah. Maybe that's why people are here.
Yeah?
I grew up with a magnet on my fridge, and it was like one of those 1950s cartoons with the speech bubble. And it was the mom talking to the daughter, and it said, "Darling, God's gift to women wasn't men, it was the shower massager." And so I just assumed that masturbation was what I was supposed
it was
to do.
Awesome.
Yeah.
That's what your mom was telling you.
Yeah.
That's exactly how she was telling you that.
I love it. Well, no wonder, Mal, welcome to the panel. Mal Clitoris Harrison, as I like to call her.
Oh, geez.
Well, no, Mal, if you haven't been aware of Mal before, if she hasn't been in your orbit, in 2011 she did a lot of research on the internal clitoris, and subsequently her article from the Museum of Sex went viral, and suddenly people were talking about the internal clitoris.
Woohoo! It's what's on the inside that counts.
What I'm curious about, since you've moved on from the Museum of Sex and, you know, moved on from studies on the internal clitoris, and now you've set up the Center for Erotic Intelligence, I'm really curious, as someone that's studying the future of sex and tech, how dating apps like Tinder, those sort of technologies are either moving us further or away from getting in touch with our erotic intelligence.
So I feel like technology in terms of dating apps, they're no different than the bar, right? They're introduction apps. But We're taking very little time. We don't see how somebody moves or expresses themselves. We don't hear how somebody speaks. We're swiping, boom, 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 or up and down if you're on field, or depending on the app, you're doing a different little fingering, so to speak. But we're losing our social intelligence. We're losing our ability to look across the room and make eye contact with somebody and pick up on subtle nuances and pick up on the unspoken language of body language. And so one of the pillars of erotic intelligence education is social intelligence. It's along with emotional intelligence. But it really is to help people pick up on how to be empathetic and to sort of read another person and think to themselves, oh, what would they like? And, you know, this ability to listen to another human's body, right? Instead of getting caught up in our own fantasy of, oh my gosh, this person wants this thing that I want, but really listening to their body. So I think that's something that's very important in today's day and age. Technology, it's an introduction site, but it's also subtracting from our ability to be socially intelligent and do the real life walk and talk of, hey, I see you across the room and we're going to talk later. So
thank you. Welcome. And last but not least, someone I've been meaning to meet for ages, internet famous for me, Tina Horn. If you're an avid podcast listener like I am, you would have already bumped into her podcast, Why Are People Into That?, which is an amazing podcast and it does what it says on the tin. it follows all sorts of interesting ideas about what people are into and why. So the latest episode was on gangbangs and following a couple about why they like that and perform in that. You've also won 2 feminist pornography awards.
It's true.
After listening to your podcast and the people that you bring on who are amazing and sort of shatter the perception of if you work in pornography or if you do sex work that you're somehow not part of humanity, these stories are really powerful to listen to because they're so human and they're about people having these relationships. And yes, they may work on porn sets, but I love just the real people stories and the cute dates that they go on. And it was amazing to me. And so in thinking about the question to ask you, again, I'm focused on the future. What does sex work look like in 2020 for people?
Thank you. First, I want to say that when you first asked about 2020, I was imagining something really far in the future. And then I sat down and think, okay, practically, can I expect that we will have global full decriminalization of sex work by 2020? And then I was like, wait.
Probably not.
That's in 3 years. All of my science. I was just watching the movie Barbed Wire. Have you guys seen this movie? The Pamela Anderson Lee movie? Yeah, I see you. And it takes place in 2017 and it's like fascist, moral imperialism has taken over. So, you know, maybe they had the right idea in the 90s. Anyway, I hope in my lifetime to see the full global decriminalization of sex work. That is very much my stance as a mostly retired, but if I may say so, prolific sex worker myself. And a lot of the people that I have on Why Are People Into That? Are sex workers, partially because that's my community, partially because sex workers are really experienced at talking about sex and also knowing how to represent themselves in an informative or performative way that is both authentic and protects whatever they want to protect about their own intimacy, what they feel like sharing and what they don't. You know, I think that one of the biggest misperceptions or disinformation that's out there about sex work is that sex workers have bad boundaries, which is, when hosts get together, we like to laugh about that because sex workers have the best boundaries because we have the most practice with them. What's the question? What is the future of sex work? I mean, I think that I would like to see, and I'm starting to see, sex workers being given the opportunity to design and influence sexual technology, because we're out here in these streets, literally, you know, in the field, talking to people and knowing how to talk to a sexual consumer, what they want and what to say to them so that you're making them think that it was their idea the whole time. Yeah, you know. I think that sex workers make the best sexuality designers of entertainment, of products, of marketing. And, you know, another thing that I would like to see is very much in so many ways that I could talk about all night, the destigmatization of sex work, which really needs to actually happen before decriminalization can happen. And one way that I would like to see sex work destigmatized is for people to hire sex workers, former sex workers, current sex workers. You know, one of the other, you know, contradictions or ironies or paradoxes that we have to deal with is that there's a lot of like white knights and like rescuers out there, white saviors, who really want to say like, oh, you like must be so exploited because I can't imagine ever choosing to do this. And I'm really uncomfortable with it. Or maybe I wish that I could. So I'm going to project my discomfort onto you, which happens in white savior stuff in all kinds of industries. But anyway.
And also like the like Africa. I mean, just like,
well, that's what
colonization
I mean.
In general.
Absolutely. Yes. Colonialism and imperialism is alive and well. Yeah, I think that a lot of people, you know, want to project or assume that sex workers would never choose to be an escort, to be a prostitute, to be a professional dominatrix, to do fetish modeling, to perform in porn, to be a cam model. There's all kinds of different ways to be a sex worker, and the sex worker rights movement has really unified that. And but then ironically, when we're like, okay. Like, I, for example, will tell you that, you know, I have stopped doing as much sex work and I'm focused on my journalism, I'm focused on podcasting, focused on publishing and teaching and speaking at colleges. And I have to constantly ask myself, you know, what can I put on my resume? You know, these things that totally qualify me, my, like, extensive experience in internet marketing. You know, my intuition. I just had a job interview the other day where they were like, we need someone who can really, who just has that je ne sais quoi of like intuition where someone walks in the door and they just really know how to give them exactly what they want. Okay, so these are skills that I wish that I could be more forthcoming about. And so I would ask everyone here to rethink what their own preconceived notions are of what it means that someone may have done sex work. Maybe they just shot one porn. Maybe they did it for one specific reason that they can point to, like college. Maybe they did it because they did, like, they had a reason like paying their fucking rent or needing to buy groceries. Like, we live in a capitalist society, so sometimes you gotta do what you gotta do, right? So, so that is what I hope to see in the future of sex work, that we destigmatize what it means to be or have been a sex worker and make space for listening to and being in dialogue with an entire like complicated discourse of what it means to be a sex worker.
I want to talk. I do some work in South Africa with girls in the townships, and one of the things that we talked about was this project, and I want to bring it up because I feel like in South Africa, it's like what our culture could look like if things just continue to go very badly with the income inequality, lack of opportunities for jobs. So these men become emasculated, and there's so much violence against women and girls there that they live in what they call, casually they call rape culture. Oh, but we're in rape culture. And to the degree that I met this man who works for the Supreme Court, he clerks, and these girls I work with went to go talk about sexual violence in the Constitution, and he said, I myself am so scared of, could I be a rapist too? Like, everyone around me is a rapist. Like, there's rape everywhere. Like, I'm afraid that I'm going to turn the corner someday and, like, rape a girl. And so everyone's living with this internalized fear of themselves and each other. And you know, when you were talking about sex work, one of the things that has been really prevalent in the conversations with girls in South Africa is sugar daddies. And duh, like these girls are desperate for food. They're desperate for school fees, and they're also desperate for love. And they find these men who are can supply them with that. And sometimes it works out very well, and sometimes it is, as you can imagine, as bad as it could be. And it's about agency, and it's about like having the self-worth, which we're talking about with these men also, of like self-love. But then it made me think too, like, well, there's also these high-end sites of like for women to connect with men or vice versa, of like situations wanted, or, you know, like there's like a, there's like different grades of all of this with
like
sex
classism.
Work. There's classes, because classism in all of this. And I think the technology is, plays an interesting role in both ways. Like it allows, women of means to look for, opportunities for paid sex in a way that it's like called something different. Right. And then, you know, then on like the, these girls in South Africa are like, you know, sugar daddies and, really vulnerable to them. So, but it made me think too about how, like drug reform came about when the senator's own community and children started getting busted for heroin.
Right.
And suddenly it's not just like crack dens in the black community. It's like, oh, the drug problem is, you know, affecting all of us. And it, yeah, it is. And so I think about like, if being paid for sex in some ways is being, is like sanctioned in the upper echelons of society, could that have a ripple down effect for sex work in general? I'd love to hear you talk about that. And but like that is happening because technology is allowing women to state their desires and find like hook up with like, you know, like we have this database of men who are willing, right? And so there's like this incredible opportunity there, but I also fear all the classism that's inherent in all of it.
It's interesting to hear everyone talk, because I think about the sort of big picture of what's happening in our country and how we're in this crisis of integrity.
Yes.
You know, we're in this world of like, you know, alternative facts.
Yes.
And that, you know, everything that comes out of everyone's mouth in the news is a lie. And so this, what I think about is what we're struggling with in the big picture is really this idea of shame versus pleasure, like you were saying. And shame comes from a, like a performance model. Shame is, you know, I can't do it the way I'm supposed to, or I'm not doing what everyone else is doing. Or in our Western culture, it's really about, you know, our sexuality in a really sort of male version of sex, about getting to the finish line, which is usually the male ejaculation. And if you can't get there, we'll get you a pill, which I have nothing against the pill, but it's totally antithetical to a pleasure model. You know, a pleasure model is about what you feel in the moment. And we have this culture for women that we have been taught that pleasure avoidance or denial is a form of control and strength. I really want that cookie, but I'm not going to eat it because that makes me strong. And so anything I can do to override my natural desire to be in a pleasurable moment either helps me rewrite the narrative of whatever story I have in my head about the power between us, or it helps me to feel in control of myself. And, you know, I think in the bigger picture, we do have a movement towards intensity and experience. So people want, because they have so much choice now,
yes.
People want intensity, they want experience, they want something that is going to be intriguing or challenging. And yet the idea is to not thin yourself out so much by seeking intensity that you lose what's in the moment. And that's where ultimately the pleasure is. And I think that's why Tantra, if you know what tantric yoga is or tantric sex, I think that's why it's growing in popularity, because it's an Eastern model of sex that's totally female driven, where you're in the moment and it doesn't matter if you have an orgasm. Let's drag it out for 10 hours. you're staying maybe 24 hours. But the whole concept of a tantra was that tantra is a form of yoga, and yoga was created thousands of years ago in order for people to have sex. It was about positions that could awaken together your kundalini energy at the base of your spine, and it would wrap around the two of you, sort of like those snakes. And the idea was that, you know, the energy that could be blown out of the top of your head by having an orgasm together was the only way you could reach God. You know, you couldn't find God on your own. It was only as a couple, as a pair. It didn't matter if you were two men, two women, a man and a woman. The idea is that that energy that's created during sex is amazingly powerful. And so the idea is not to get thinner about our desires and seeking always that stimulation, but to get deeper. And I think that's what, you know, kids that I know, my kids, my son, who's now 21, you know, grew up on porn. The access that he had, it was nothing like what I had when I was a kid. So his sexual cathexis, your cathexis is the thing that is integrated into you about who you're going to desire and what you want. And it's based on your first masturbatory experiences. It really has nothing to do with porn. It has to do with masturbation. So anything that ends in an orgasm is the greatest behavioral reinforcer that you can experience. There's nothing more pleasurable. So it creates like this deer path in the woods. Anything that ends in orgasm, you're going to repeat over and over and over. And so the idea of combining that energy with that neurological pathway with someone that you feel you can trust, not that you feel safe with, but someone that you can trust, it can bring you to these, you know, waves of pleasure and also this internal spiritual experience, which I think is what's lacking in people who are my son's age. So he's in a relationship where he's like, oh yeah, sex, you know, I've seen it all, I've done it, I know it, but how do I have an emotional connection with a girl? Like that I don't get. And he wants it so bad, and so do all his friends, and that's what they talk about. They're like, oh, triple anal, whatever, I've seen it. But emotion, like telling a girl how I feel, like that's a mystery. And so I think the idea of pleasure that you can find in a relationship, whether it's with one person or many, it's about integrity. It's integrating all the parts of you. This is who I am. I like anal sex. I like group sex. I want to be in love. I want tantra. Whatever it is, integrity means integrating all the parts of you and not hiding something because of shame. You know, we're so good at compartmentalizing. We have our porn over here, our phone over there, our masturbation over there, our real fantasy over there. You know, we're not integrated. Integrated means remembering the dismembered parts of you and being able to say, this is me. Like, transparent, vulnerable. That's what intimacy is. And I don't know about you, but I get off on intimacy. I think it's hot.
You said something just before that I wanted to come back to, which was if you're with this partner and you're talking about tantra, don't be safe. It's not about being safe. It's about trusting them. Can you explain the difference there?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Like really good sex is illicit and naughty and forbidden and a little edgy. And you should feel, I know I've said this in front of you before, you should feel incredibly embarrassed after you have good sex. You should be like, oh, my God, I can't believe I made that noise. I can't believe I went to that place that I trusted so much in that moment that I could explore those places I didn't even know I wanted to go to. And that's different than safe. That's the opposite of safe. You know, you should push your edge into places that feel totally not safe. And that's what makes it hot. You know, the idea is, do you have to have that every Tuesday? Well, you know, you can have maintenance sex. That's okay, too. That's all good.
Talk about maintenance sex real quick.
Maintenance sex is like sweatpants sex. You know, you don't have to you don't have to dress up, you don't have to shave. But
yeah, it does what it says on the tin too.
Exactly. It's like rollover
maintenance
sex.
I feel like maintenance sex is definitely what you have to have so you have the really, really good sex. Yeah. It's so important.
It keeps you connected in between those really, really good nights.
Yeah. I always tell people I've never met someone who has regretted going to the gym. But I've met plenty of people who have said, I was too tired, I didn't feel like it, I wasn't in the mood to go to the gym. But nobody ever regrets going to the gym after, and it's the same with sex. Like, if you're not in the mood, but you're just willing to, and you do it, and, you know, it's not the best thing in the world, it's that maintenance sex that keeps your body in good shape for the really, really good sex.
And also, it's like showing up for your partner.
Yeah.
You know, it's like saying, this is our committed space together, and sometimes I'm going to feel like doing it, and sometimes I'm not.
Yeah.
I tell this story a lot. I used to have a partner. Well, actually, I've had many. Okay. Surprising everyone in the room, I've always had a higher sex drive than everyone that I've ever been with. Men, women, trans people. When I was younger, a lot of my partners would use what the word that I came to think of as like the dreaded P word, which is pressure. It would be like, oh, you're putting so much pressure on me. And I was like, I just want to fuck, you know? And, and so I specifically with one partner, that I had in my late 20s, he would say, well, why don't you, I would be like, hey, man, do you want to, and he'd be like, oh, I'm tired. I like, don't really feel like, well, what if you're so horny, why don't you just masturbate? And at the time that made me feel the opposite of sexy. It was total boner killer. It made me want to cry, actually, and not like the good cry. The good sexy kind of cry. You know what I mean? It made me feel less intimacy with him. And made me feel really, really alienated. And the idea of masturbation being satisfying in that moment was like anathema to me. In my current relationship, which has always been based on openness and adventure I could credit why this is so functional to a lot of different things, mostly just like turning every conflict into a kinky sex game. But now, when I am, you know, when I try to like seduce my current partner and she's too tired or she's not feeling it, I don't see that as an insult, or as like an affront to me or a reflection on my self-worth, which is, I love what you were saying about shame, and that idea of like not living up to something. And so now I don't feel like masturbation next to her in bed is like a consolation prize. You know, it feels like exciting and fun. And also it feels like, isn't it so great that I can be, that we can be alone together, basically, and that I can enjoy and appreciate that. And so that like exact same dynamic of like solo sex, I'm obviously boring this person so much right down there. Fantastic, more power to you. Anyway, I feel like I've made my like overarching point is that, you know, the same like thing with different relationship dynamics can make you feel totally different.
This event was sponsored by Unbound Babes, which is basically like Sephora for your vagina. You log on to unboundbabes.com and you will see a wide, vast, endless almost range of products for the rebellious feminist in you, or the feminist in your life, or the woman in your life, or maybe you. So check out unboundbabes.com. And to end the session today, like I do with most of my podcasts, I asked our guests a question about the future. This time I invited the group to think about the future of sex in terms of sex robots. What is the future of sex robots?
I think you can't hold back the future. I mean, it's going to happen whether people are trying to stop it or not. Anyone with enough money can get a pretty good doll. And so I think, first of all, it's going to be something of for people of privilege. And so it's going to have a status symbol to it. Mm. So that, you know, you used to drive like a Porsche, now you have a sex robot. And so I think it also will attract people who, again, are sort of looking for
the next thing.
The new novelty.
The novelty, but also like the pressure to project all your stuff onto something that you imagine is going to be lifelike, because that's what happens. Mm-hmm. So you project, you know, we've all seen the movies where, you know, the woman sexy robot becomes like a real heart-filled person. Mm. And I think that's going to be the ultimate fantasy and the disappointment. So, because it'll give you all the masturbatory experiences that you want and all the sort of interesting new sexual positions, but it's going to take us away from that place of like deeper energetic connection. And can we have both? Mm. Can we have both? Can you have a sex doll one night and then a deep emotional tantric experience with your partner the next night?
Yes.
Again, that's integrity. It depends. Some people will be able to do it that have integrity and can integrate all those parts and are sort of balanced in their life. Other people will be obsessed, mm-hmm. like they are with everything. Mm-hmm. That's my guess.
Mm-hmm. That's pretty good. I don't
want to touch that. Well, so I feel like we as human beings, we assign meaning to so many things, right? So we try to define what is a normative, you know, frequency of having sex with our partners. We try to make everything normal, and we assign meaning to the size of the rock our partner gives us, or the ring because it was the grandmother's ring, or our grandmother's scarf, or, you know, this car that our grandfather drove. Like, we assign meaning to objects and to things. So if we have that capability with our imaginations, I foresee that capability happening with people assigning meaning to sex dolls. I think on one hand, women will be able to finally sort of indulge themselves in pleasure if they have a sex doll and they're like, I don't give a shit about you and your pleasure. If I'm bending your dick the wrong way, I'm sitting on it and riding it and it feels fucking good. I think that's going to be much more of a possibility. And I think that's something a lot of us aren't thinking about. I have plenty of female clients who are incapable of relinquishing themselves from the duty of ensuring that he has pleasure before they do. And so I think a sex robot is going to change that in a huge way, in ways that none of us are thinking about. We're all thinking about guys going to sex doll and sex robot brothels. But I actually think, because one just opened in Barcelona, their sights are set on London, there's a sex doll brothel that's there. And the question really is, like, what's the age of consent? Can my 10-year-old son who gets a boner in his sleep go and fuck a sex doll? Is that okay? I mean, these are major, I don't have a 10-year-old son, but if I did, I'd be petrified. These are major questions that are facing humanity that we're not thinking about. But I think for females, something a lot of people aren't realizing is that there's this potential to finally indulge in what makes us feel good.
Wondering about the technology of sex dolls as it advances and we have these sexual robotic partners, if we're not going to see hybrids, and if we're not going to be like, are we going to upgrade the cock? Are we going to upgrade the pussy? Like, what happens when you get the implant?
Like cyborgs.
We're cyborg. Like, we're heading that way, really, of our bodies becoming increasingly robotic.
And joint replacements.
And joint replacements. Why? Yeah. What could this look like? And
okay. I, for one, welcome our sexbot overlords. I started to become, last year, actually really obsessed with, the idea of sex robots as essentially the sex labor force of the future. I wrote this essay. It's published on Jezebel. It's called, what would it take for a sex robot to pass a Turing test? And if you don't know, a Turing test is basically when a robot or artificial intelligence convinces a human that it is real, or like is indistinguishable, where robot or artificially intelligent consciousness is indistinguishable from human consciousness to a human. One of the things that I found in my research writing this essay was statistics about Ashley Madison. So for those of you who don't know, Ashley Madison is still a website that explicitly facilitates people meeting for extramarital arrangements. And so when someone hacked them part of the information that was released that Ashley Madison admitted to, some staggering amount of the software of the profiles on Ashley Madison were bots designed to, like, if you say, like, hi, how are you? She'll be like, my favorite color is gray. So a staggering amount of men were completely fooled by these fembots, essentially, software. And so they didn't even need to have, like, a realistic sex robot with, like, fake flesh that, like, looks you and makes eye contact with you and has, like, a character and a personality. Like, they were totally fooled. And my one of my conclusions from that is, if there's software out there that can be programmed to do all of the emotional labor that women have been doing for men since the beginning of time, then maybe, and I'm not being a misandrist here, I love you, all men, not all men, you know, if obviously this is entertaining for people, right? So if you think about it as entertainment, like, if men can be entertained by these fembots, then that might leave women free to do literally whatever we want.
That's it for this discussion. Thanks for listening to Future of Sex Salon Series Special. This podcast was produced and edited by Chad Michael Snavely. To get in touch with Chad or check out the other podcasts he's producing, visit chadmichael.com. And if you have any questions, feedback, just want to say hey, you can follow me on Twitter, Facebook or Instagram. I'm at Briony Cole, BRYONYCOLE. And of course, make sure you're following Future of Sex on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We're out there. And we will see you next time. Thanks for listening.